had a number of collaborators. I'll be talking about various pieces of work that's been actually going on for over a decade now. And there's a new preprint on the archive just this past week, which I'll also mention. So an organizing principle of basically all of physics that we've come to rely on quite a bit since Wilson is the idea of effective field theories and decoupling of degrees of freedom from high energy down to low, from the ultraviolet down to the infrared. And the question that has intrigued me for one of the questions is, how do we apply this approach in a very consistent quantum field theoretic way to gravity? We know, of course, that we have also light degrees of freedom, and they don't decouple. And we also know that we have anomalies, the chiral anomaly and the conformal anomaly. And as I will try to argue here, these are actually very special, and we should think very carefully about them. They did play a very important role in QCD and actually give us some kind of window into short distance physics and actually a loophole in the usual way that one thinks about effective theories. So that's going to be my main theme, that there is some infrared or low energy sensitivity to ultraviolet degrees of freedom. And that window, sort of the crack in what might be a window into short distance physics, is coming from anomalies, in particular the conformal anomaly, when we talk about gravitational interactions. And I, this body of work, I won't be able to touch on all of it, but basically the claim is, to say it right up front, is that there are macroscopic effects in black hole physics and cosmology that could be testable if we take the conformal anomaly and its consequences very seriously. So does that advance? Yes. Okay, so familiar things. If you go back and look at the chiral anomaly and the important role it played in the development of QCD, we know that if you write down the QCD Lagrangian, you apparently have a full UN flavor, of course, UN flavor chiral symmetry, but the UN chiral symmetry is anomalous. And we have this U1 problem to explain why the singlet, pseudoscalar singlet state is heavier than the pions. And the beautiful explanation of that, due also to Gerhard, is that there is an anomalous effect. So this is the Adler-Belzec-Keefe anomaly that was discussed in great detail in the 60s. And if you consider the decay, for example, of the pi meson, just two electromagnetic interactions to two photons, then as we understand it, it goes through this kind of diagram, the famous triangle. And this anomalous effect, which cannot be removed by any local renormalizable interaction, gives rise to a lower symmetry and the measured decay rate. And go back and look at the history of QCD. It actually played a very important role because the charge assignments of the quarks in the standard SU3 color model is crucial to getting the coefficient right for this pi naught to two gamma decay rate. And that is actually quite an intriguing statement there, because you do a calculation in QCD in the short distance physics and essentially a perturbative diagram, and you apply that to a low energy amplitude for a pion, which is quite a bit lighter than the QCD scale, almost a Goldstone boson, and in a confined theory, and you nevertheless get essentially the right answer. So this, of course, gives rise to Gerhard's principle of anomaly matching of infrared and ultraviolet. And I think the lessons that one can learn from the chiral case are very important for carrying over into the conformal anomaly case. So there is a window. Here is an example of infrared physics or long distance physics from the ultraviolet. So, okay, this is just a quick review of the triangle anomaly. I remind you that if you'd write down this triangle diagram, let's stick even to QED for the moment, then this is the divergence of the axial current in Fourier space. And if you compute this diagram with a massive fermion, you find that in the massless limit, you get the famous coefficient of the anomaly. Whereas if you take the mass to infinity, of course, you get decoupling. And that's how decoupling works in this diagram. Then the mass effects suppress the anomaly, and the anomaly goes away. So it can be a scale-dependent effect that I have to look at scales that some momentum scale has to be large compared to the mass running around this diagram if there is a mass, or I have to go to the massless limit. That may be important later in what we have to say about how to interpret the conformal anomaly in low energy physics. So you can always represent that amplitude as a part which has nothing to do with the anomaly, which is, if you wish, transverse, so that k mu dotted into this is zero, and another part which must behave like a massless pole, so that k mu dotted into this will cancel this k squared and just give you the anomaly. It's not usually presented this way, but it can be. And we looked very carefully at these amplitudes, both in the chiral case and in the conformal case in those series of papers I mentioned at the beginning. And the very interesting, curious feature here, which I think is somewhat underappreciated in the literature, is that there is this massless state, which you can think of as for massless fermions, which you can think of as a two-particle correlated state between, if you cut this diagram, the imaginary part actually exhibits a delta function singularity at the origin for its center of mass energy, zero. So the imaginary part has a delta function, and it's telling you that there is an effective degree of freedom inside this diagram, which is coming from a collective mode, from a two-particle intermediate state. By the way, there's a sum rule you can also prove for any mass that's finite. So if you try to just think about what would I write down to generate this anomaly as at the level, say, of the 1 PI effect of action, you would have to introduce some kind of inverse propagator some propagator between the anomaly, this is script A, at a point Y, and an external chiral gauge potential such that when I vary with respect to that external potential, I get the anomalous current diagram. So this would be the minimal thing you could write down, which would generate the anomalous pole coming from the 1 over k squared in this propagator. But you can also write this down in a local form. And for that, you introduce a field I call eta, which is basically a phase field that will couple to the anomaly, and because of the periodicity associated with the anomaly, it will actually be a 2 pi periodic or 4 pi periodic phase field. And if you do it this way, then you see very quickly that there is a degree of freedom which is associated with this eta. Now it's a local degree of freedom, because if I calculate the canonical momentum of this action varying with respect to eta dot, then I, of course, just pick up the time component of the current, and just canonical commutation relation will then tell me that I should quantize the system if I were just given this Lagrangian by this commutator. And this canonical commutator in this anomalous action is in fact completely equivalent to the anomalous current commutators in the Schwinger terms. So if you go back to the underlying field theory, Schwinger noticed a long time ago that there have to be some anomalous current commutators called Schwinger terms between electromagnetic currents and the chiral current. And if you postulate this commutation relation for the eta field and then just vary this with respect to the gauge field, you'll get exactly the anomalous current commutators of the Schwinger term, which are now reinterpreted as canonical commutators of this effect of action. And the chiral rotation of the eta phase is just.
So are you saying eta is the electric current? Or
no, eta is a new field which I introduced.
So do you relate to the.
To localize the action, but the anomaly, of course, is eta dual. So it depends on the gauge field. And so if I vary this action with respect to the ordinary gauge field, I get a current. And
but how do you go from this commutator to
and
the
then
Schwinger
I go from this commutator, I didn't write all the steps, but if I go from this commutator to those current commutators, I get exactly the Schwinger term. So this is in effect equivalent to the Schwinger commutator. So discussing this also about the first principle, this is in the last preprint last week, just to put this in the context of what we're going to say later. So if you now look at this kind of object, and you will see that the Goldstone theorem basically goes through. I learned myself that anomalies were small.
I think you
dropped it. I was wondering where that. Now it came apart. Okay. So I learned long ago that anomalies were explicit breakings of symmetry, not and therefore different from spontaneous. In fact, or you would think it doesn't immediately apply there. How do you get this on? Let's try it. Okay. Is that working now? Okay. But in fact, by using this anomalous commutator, so you can actually derive an anomalous form of Goldstone's theorem, because this phase angle now is non-commuting with the current due to that commutator I just wrote down. So if you just now run through what would be a standard application of Goldstone's theorem, calculate the divergence of this object because of the time ordering, you'll pick up a delta function term and the commutator, and therefore you'll get this four-dimensional delta function. So if this object has a non-zero expectation value, let's call it z-naught, then you just immediately see Fourier transforming this, that this Lorentz invariant function must have a Lorentz invariant form because of this index lambda. So if I just carry this out in Fourier space, I find that k squared f of k squared is equal to z naught. That's the anomalous Ward identity, essentially. And therefore, there must be a Goldstone pole. So this phenomenon is quite general and shows that there is a new application of Goldstone's theorem. And this pole is really something that you should expect every time you have an anomaly. Here, I've done it for the chiral case. So this is a general consequence, which surely is a low energy degree of freedom. So we did some analysis. I'll skip this in detail unless you're interested. We can talk later. But we carried out the same analysis for electromagnetism first, but coupling to the stress tensor. And there, people had found the conformal anomaly long ago. This is in flat space, but in a background gauge field. And it's very analogous to the chiral anomaly. The same triangle diagram contributes, where I replace the chiral current by the stress tensor. And it was known by heat kernel methods some time ago that instead of FF dual, because this is a scalar, you get F squared. And now it's a bit more complicated to carry through the Feynman diagram analysis because of all the indices. So there are a lot of structures. But basically, the important one is this one. And there's some, this just comes from conservation on these indices, current conservation and energy momentum conservation. And here's some scalar function. And you go ahead and compute this, and you find this 1 over k squared pole again. And again, if you look at the imaginary part, you write down the dispersive relation, then you'll see that there is, in fact, the delta function, which you can easily miss if you do it too quickly, because it's right at the tip, the endpoint of the of the dispersion integral, but the way to do it is to put a mass regulator in here, and then you'll see that there is basically a spectral function that obeys a finite sum rule, is such that it gets steeper and steeper and narrower and narrower as I take the mass to zero and eventually becomes a delta function. So again, this is another test of this idea of having a massless state if you have massless particles running around a loop. So what is this? Let's try to get to the point quickly. What does this have to do with gravity? Well, now I'm coupling to the stress tensor. So in Einstein's theory, we usually, as we all learned, talk about the transverse trace-free spin two parts of the graviton. And if we look at this diagram as a tree-level diagram, we would say that the only propagating modes there are the transverse modes. And the scalar parts you can decompose, of course, in a tensor decomposition, but the only propagating parts are the transverse parts, and the other parts, like the scalar part, are non-propagating, like the Coulomb field in electromagnetism. But if I now consider this one loop diagram with the triangle attached here that I just looked at, then in effect, you generate this massless pole from this intermediate two-particle state, and you can now think of this in an effective field theory as an exchange of a scalar mode, because if you go through it, the I epsilon prescriptions and so forth, you'll find this really is a propagating state in between here. And this couples to the trace anomaly. So in this just two-photon scattering diagram, you predict that there will be also a scalar state. Of course, in the real world, electron is the lightest charged particle, so this will be suppressed by the mass of the electron. But it's just a prediction of one-loop standard model physics that I should see some kind of additional propagator here when I look at momentum exchanges, which are much larger than the electron mass, so many MeVs.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
In the previous discussion of the conjugal case, are you saying QCD contains an extra state we've missed somehow?
Well, that state in QCD, of course, becomes it's in the U1 sector, so that becomes the eta prime. Okay, so if you go through it and look, for example, at the Veneziano's description of this, you add another operator, and that gives a mass to that state, and that becomes the eta prime mass, and that solves the U1 problem, right? So you have to think about other interactions and what the effect of theory is. But naively, you do have this massless state. And this, I found, is not very well clearly discussed in most of the textbooks.
Well, there's another issue.
But it could have been done 40 years ago.
Diagrams are very ambiguous because of linear divergences. In Adler's calculation, he has to consider the vector curve.
Yeah.
So he adds a particular set of counter terms to that diagram.
Yeah.
And if I was a topologist, I wouldn't add those terms that get 1 over 24 pi squared instead of 1 over 8 pi squared for the anomaly coefficient.
Well, actually, this approach, I should have mentioned, follows the approach of Dolgoff, where basically you look at it from a dispersive approach. So you can always calculate the imaginary parts. They're non-divergent. And then you can construct the real parts from the imaginary parts using gauge invariance. And that fixes that ambiguity totally. But that's a technicality. Anyway, so I think it's unambiguous, finally, in the end. Now, we want to go to a full theory, not just looking at background gauge fields. So I want to consider also coupling into all the gravitational degrees of freedom, like gravitons. And so you really have to look at the three-point function of stress tensors, not T and two electromagnetic currents. And then you know there are massless states, right? There are photons that contribute to the TTT correlator. And this same general phenomenon should happen. We recently showed that in a paper a few years ago. So this phenomenon
is really important. I think this now goes on there.
Maybe I should just hold it. All right, so I think I'll skip over this for lack of time, but there are many other examples that you can bring out. One of them is in 2D gravity, where very quickly, if you write down what you think is the low energy effective action of 2D gravity, because R, you know, go up to two derivatives, in fact, this object is a topological invariant. There's no local degrees of freedom, and you would say it's a completely null theory. It's overconstrained. However, basically because the scale of curvature is a total derivative. However, when you look at quantum fields in any general 2D curve background, you will find an anomaly, in this case just proportional to the Ricci scalar. And this is called the central charge in the stringy-like literature. And you can then construct an effective action from this very quickly. And that was basically done by Polyakov. And you can write it in this non-covariant-looking form, where you select out a background metric called G bar. And this is the conformal fiber, basically, the conformal equivalence class of that metric. But you could also solve this equation for sigma and eliminate. I could turn this equation around and solve this equation for sigma, and then I could write a non-local action. And that non-local action is basically the Polyakov action, and this exhibits immediately this scalar pole. So either you think about it non-locally this way, and you have this scalar pole, or you can think about it either here or here. You then introduce again a scalar field called phi, which when you integrate it out, just gives you back this action. And this is now fully generally covariant. Of course, this phi is nothing else than some conformal deformation of the metric. But now this is in a general covariant form. So here again, you see a degree of freedom appear from the anomaly. And if you now reconsider the theory with this term added, you have an extra degree of freedom. And this is what the string theorists call the shift in the central charge coming from the conformal mode itself. If you look at the TT correlator in flat space, then you will again see then it's a very simple structure in two dimensions, and this scalar function will obey the Goldstone theorem. It has the pole. Okay. So again, it's another so the main claim then is that we can generalize this idea to four-dimensional gravity and look at the metric conformal factor, which was constrained and becomes dynamical. This is what happens in 2D. And this certainly changes 2D physics, right? Because this goes under the name of gravitational dressing. So if I take a conformal field theory in 2D and allow the metric on which it lives to fluctuate, I actually do get the Polyakov term. This has been checked, for example, by putting ICE models on random lattices, or even in some applications to biology, to polymers and things. So anyway, it's pretty clear also from lattice simulations that this term does affect long distance physics. In fact, it changes the fixed point, the conformal fixed point behavior and critical exponents. It's certainly not a purely short distance phenomenon. So there's another infrared relevant operator that you have to add into the effective theory in order to get this. So the basic idea is to carry this out in four dimensions and start with a semi-classical picture of gravity, for starters. And you look at the stress tensor coupled to Einstein, and you ask, what kind of effects are there when I try to quantize fields in a curved background? And you, again, immediately find an anomaly. In this case, the conformal anomaly. There can be the F squared terms if you couple to gauge fields that I just discussed. But in a general curved background, you'll get this structures, which is known in general. There'll be a Weyl tensor squared, and there'll be, this is the Euler-Gauss-Bernet invariant. And I choose to write it in this combination for reasons you'll see later. And then I can just put a B double prime box R there. These are basically all the operators of dimension four, which are scalars and you know depend only on the metric. These are gauge field operators. So and this term in fact can be written as a total is a variation of a local action. So it's not a true anomaly. You can always remove this by a counter term. And these are the terms that are the relevant ones. And I was skipping the details. One can write down, discuss if you want later, but basically one can write down a conformal invariant, a conformal covariant action, which gives rise to this anomaly. And it immediately brings in the analog of the propagator in two dimensions, which comes from R, is the box, just ordinary wave operator. But now I get a new operator, which is fourth order in derivatives. It's delta 4, I think I've written on one of the slides. And so now the anomaly is given by this. And basically, the equation of motion you get if you write it in the local form is this fourth order wave operator on the scalar, this new scalar, which I call a conformal line, just because they don't want it to be confused with dilatons that people talk about. It is not a dilaton in the usual sense, although, of course, its origin is quite similar. So this is a quadratic action in the phi field. Its phi equation of motion is this. If I solve this equation of motion and put it back, I essentially get this anomaly non-local term again. And now this thing is a propagating degree of freedom. It has kinetic terms. These are the coefficients known for free fields for a long time. So the idea is nothing short of just putting this term in the action and claiming that it should be taken into account just from standard model physics. The effective action now is the Einstein-Hilbert action you know and love, but this additional anomalous term, which if you like to use this language, is a non-trivial modification of general relativity because it introduces a new scalar, but not one I invented because I wanted, but because I have this thing given to me, whether I like it or not, which is the conformal anomaly. And I will talk about fluctuations perhaps after lunch in the discussion session. But now let's try to see what comes out of this. So you have a scalar degree of freedom. You can ask, well, what happens, for example, if I linearize this equation with this is now the stress tensor of this field, which I think I wrote down somewhere, but it's a long expression. Never mind, it's known. And if you now linearize around flat space, do the usual decomposition in a covariant way, and look at the Einstein constraints in the TT and TI components, something quite interesting happens, because the first thing people worry about usually when I write down that action is, well, it's delta 4, it's a fourth order term, don't I have to worry about ghosts? Well, you do have to worry, but remember, this came from ordinary standard model physics in a curved space, so it should somehow not be a disaster. And basically, all the tests that we've been able to do show that this is indeed the case. So here, I'm just linearizing around flat space. What you find is this kind of structure. You have some parts of the metric, which I called here H and W, in this decomposition, which are gauge invariant variables. And of course, if there were no anomaly term, if this were zero, then this would just be a pure elliptic operator like a Coulomb potential. And up to boundary conditions, I could put this to zero. And that's the statement that there's no scalar waves in Einstein's theory. You see the structure here is a first order in time and a Laplacian. What happens now is that I have this additional field, and the structure is such that it just gives me the same operator, but operating on something which is box phi. So it means that you can solve these constraints. It means that the half of the degrees of freedom that are in this fourth order operator are gone, because if box phi is zero, it doesn't couple at linear order anyway to the metric. But those solutions which are solutions of the fourth order equation, which is this box squared phi equals zero, but box phi non-zero do couple. Okay, so you get a scalar breathing mode, a gravitational wave that wasn't in the Einstein theory. You can also do this in a space plus time split using essentially Jim Bardeen's gauge invariant variables, write down the potentials, and you find the same structure that the gauge invariant potentials, I call them epsilon, not to confuse it with phi, are given by the box phi part of the scalar mode. So you solve the constraints, and you find that there is a scalar mode, one mode, which is propagating like an ordinary wave, obeying a second-order wave equation. This potential now obeys a second-order wave equation. So this makes perfectly good sense. You can calculate its energy. It's positive. And you can look at what it does, you know, carry through the gravitational wave calculations. You need a propagator for this object. You work out the propagator. The source is the anomaly. And you can see what this does to experiments like LIGO. It will produce a delta L over L, which is this. And it falls off like 1 over R, just like the transverse part, only now the source is not the quadrupole moment, but the anomaly in a retarded time. So if you Fourier transform this, you get an analog of the Einstein quadrupole formula, but now it's a monopole formula, where it's the total power in the scalar mode is just given by the integral of the anomaly coefficient. So the crucial question then is, can I see this effect? Well, you now go through estimating all the terms in the anomaly, and you'll find that most of them are very small. Certainly, for standard physical applications, like in a neutron star merger, these terms are extremely small, and you will never see them. We looked at electromagnetism, and even taking the strongest possible magnetic fields, like in magnetars, this still turns out to be a very small effect. So it's not large enough in electromagnetism to be observed in LIGO. However, if you now look at the QCD anomaly, there is a chance, because in pure QCD, we have also an anomaly, which is proportional to the trace of the gluon field strength squared. And this can be quite large, okay? And in a neutron star merger, if you try to estimate this back of the envelope, you do get something which is very interesting and within the LIGO range. However, of course, this is a naive estimate because it's based on massless quarks and in the pure QCD phase. And what one really needs to do is ask how much of this can actually be excited in a neutron star merger, because clearly I have to have something which is varying in time in order to produce a wave, and I won't get just a neutron star which is just sitting there may have a gluon condensate, but it's not going to excite any gravitational waves unless I do something violent, like collide them together and excite this condensate. So this is an order of magnitude estimate, but we clearly have to do a better job of connecting the trace anomaly of pure QCD to the actual neutron star equation of state, and if you wish, the effect of Bragg constant in a neutron star. But it looks like it could possibly be important, and I'm trying to get people to think about looking for this. I won't go into the possibilities of black holes. How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
Okay. So we've looked at a lot of different things with various collaborators. So there is a stress tensor that you can derive from this anomaly. I already used it to look at small perturbations around flat space and this gravitational wave. But even perhaps more interesting, or as interesting, is what happens. You can look at this in various backgrounds, like Schwarzschild, De Sitter, and cosmological backgrounds. So this, since this is a workshop on simplicity, I thought I would show you the very simple form this stress tensor takes. It's known. Okay, here's the fourth order operator, by the way. Okay, it looks like this. It factorizes in some nice ways. It has some very nice conformal properties. So you can look at that stress tensor, and you can look at it in space-times near horizons. The important point is that it's non-local, remember, in terms of the curvatures, so it has no reason to be small, particularly near a horizon. And therefore, there can be interesting quantum effects associated with the conformal anomaly. Secondly, if you look at near horizon geometries, it in fact becomes more and more conformal in the sense that mass scales become irrelevant because you have this kinematic blue shift, and you can just look at the wave equation and see that the masses become irrelevant very close to the horizon. So the conformal behavior there is actually essential, and the conformal anomaly is actually the most important term near the horizon. And this also, by the way, gives meaning. People sometimes say nothing can happen at the horizon because it's a coordinate invariant, you know, principle of equivalence you have to go through. However, that's a local statement based on local GR, just curvatures, but this trace anomaly effect is clearly non-local. It takes into account quantum correlations, and it's not just dependent on the horizon. It's not just dependent on the curvature. This connects to what I was talking about last week at the black hole meeting. Okay, this is just stating the kinematic fact that if you look at the ordinary wave equation and look at the scattering in the effective potential of a black hole in the Schwarzschild geometry, that near to the horizon, the mass scale becomes irrelevant because this f of r is just 1 minus 2m over r. Okay, so this, you can just categorize all of this conformal field theory count. So let's apply this now to Schwarzschild. So in Schwarzschild, here's the Schwarzschild metric. The important thing is that this phi field will have a solution which is just basically proportional to the conformal transformation that I make on the time variable. This thing is really big. Just going to hold it. If you make this conformal transformation on the time variable, not here. So if you think of factorizing out this factor here, then you're basically making a very large coordinate transformation in time. And time is important because that's what determines positive and negative frequencies, and therefore what the vacuum is doing. So this conformal effective action from the anomaly is keeping track of what's happening to the quantum vacuum state as they get close to the horizon in a way that you can't just do it by local physics. So there's a solution of the equation in which phi is just the conformal factor. If I take out this factor and write it as e to the 2 sigma, then phi is just the log of this 1 minus 2m over r, and that goes to infinity. So that, if you then plug that in to the stress tensor, you will get significantly large effects. And this is a completely coordinate invariant statement because it's dependent on the magnitude of the time-like killing field in this geometry. It happens to be a non-local statement, but it's certainly coordinate invariant. Okay, so it's easy enough for a static background to just solve the equation, that fourth order equation, without time, just looking at radial dependence. Phi is a function of r. It involves nothing more complicated than logarithms. And these are integration constants. Since I have a differential operator, I can obviously have homogeneous solutions which involve integration constants. And I call those C infinity, CH, and Q, because one of them basically determines the behavior at infinity. The other determines the behavior near the horizon. And the other is actually related to the Euler-Gauss-Bonnet invariant. So it's some kind of topological charge. The only way to, what you see at a glance from this formula is the only way to have phi fall off at infinity is to put both of these constants to zero. But the only way to have finiteness in the horizon is to put this equal to zero and q equal to 2. So there's a mismatch. And within this conformal anomaly effective action for static geometries, you're basically forced to choose. The theory, of course, doesn't tell you what the right thing to do is. It simply tells you that you have to make a choice. Either something is going to happen at infinity, or something is going to happen at the horizon. And this is reflecting somehow the topological obstruction that that is present in the Schwarzschild background because of the conformal anomaly. By the way, this is completely different than flat space. If you do it in flat space, there wouldn't be any such obstruction. So it's keeping track of some global property of the vacuum, in other words. If you look at this, just in terms of these integration constants, you therefore have two conditions on three integration constants for horizon finiteness. So just naively, you would say the generic state is going to have this behavior on the horizon, which is not smooth. So in fact, what we did is look, for example, at the stress tensor that comes from that effect of action in what is called the Bulwer state. And this is where you have this divergence. This was known long before our work in the 70s, that if you take the usual vacuum state at infinity, basically nothing happening at infinity, and you quantize a scalar field, an ordinary spin zero field, then you're forced to have a divergence on the horizon. People don't like this state in GR because they say, well, nothing should happen at the horizon. But it's a perfectly well-defined state in quantum field theory, and in fact, the most reasonable one from the point of view of infinity. And numerically, people worked hard, these folks, in order to calculate what happens to the stress tensor near the horizon. Those are these points. There was another attempt to make a WKB-like approximation due to Page, Brown, and Ottewill, and this is what we can fit with our two constants to the behavior. So the conformal anomaly actually predicts this or gives a very good fit to this behavior near the horizon. I don't know if I should go into De Sitter space right now. I should have had another slide here on black holes. So basically, before you go to De Sitter, this tells you that you can generically get behavior on the horizon, like I was talking about last week. So coming from this conformal anomaly effect of action, you'll basically get some behavior which looks like this. If you plug in, take the derivatives of that logarithm, you'll actually get this divergence on the horizon. What happened? So this behavior is actually this behavior, minus two behavior. So, and this is completely coordinate invariant thing. You can write it down in terms of that scalar field. So the usual statement that quantum effects have to be small is just based on the statement that for very large masses, the natural scale for this object is 1 over m fourth, so very large black holes should have very small quantum effects, people say. However, in this kind of state, you always get this divergence, which means that there is always a regime in which these quantum effects can beat this. And in fact, this is what I was talking about last week. If you get within a Planck length of the Schwarzschild radius, then and that corresponds to a physical length scale because of this metric factor that corresponds to a physical length scale, which is like L Planck times the Schwarzschild radius. When you get within that scale, then this term becomes significant and can give you a big back reaction and actually change completely what a black hole is. So all these statements that we talked about last week, for those of you who weren't here, all the statements about entropy and how they could be resolved, they could be resolved by these large back reaction effects, and a black hole being quite different from what you think it is from classical considerations alone. So
what do you think about these people claim to see, some groups claim to see echoes and LIGO markers?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no, the evidence is inconclusive right now. But this, so I talked about sort of half the problem last week about what could be the eventual resolution and what a black hole might look like, in which it would be not a black hole at all, but an object with a P equal minus rho interior, an actual surface with a surface tension, and in Schwarzschild outside, this for the non-rotating case. And if you were there or someone asked, you know, you ask where can this effect come from? Well, it can come from this. So the conformal anomaly effect of action can produce the large effects. And it's really just a way of repackaging quantum field theory in curve space in a very simple way. And if you have these big vacuum polarization effects on the horizon, it can induce exactly this transition to something quite different. And in that object, then you could talk about echoes. Because then it will have a centrifugal barrier, and it's no longer a black hole. So things can go in and out in principle. Yeah.
So I would say that, you know, if you really have a black hole, then the Bloor state is not a valid quantum state for a black hole. The under state is.
Well, that's an assertion.
That's no singularity on the horizon.
I mean, as I said, there are states which have no singularity, but that's a set of measure zero.
It really applies if you have a
some
star, got a star in equilibrium whose surface is just very, you know, very close to the horizon.
Yeah.
That in that situation, then the Bloor state is a valid quantum state to consider. But I don't think you could conclude from that there has to be a gravistar. Just that if you have a gravistar, then you have the Bloor.
Yeah, I'm saying there's a consistent path to producing a gravistar. The real question you're asking is, can I produce these states in a dynamical collapse process? And that's a much harder question. But just by looking at what you agree is the right state for a star in a static configuration, and you know, as a Gedanken experiment, I can think of adiabatically reducing the radius of that object, whatever it is, to a white dwarf, to a neutron star. I can't do this in practice, but if I could imagine turning down the nuclear reactions in the center, then adiabatically, this thing would go closer and closer and closer to the horizon, and that would be the appropriate state.
Equation state, well, but the only way to get something in equilibrium at the horizon is if you have a huge hoop stress at the horizon, and if, that's not what would happen by any sort of reasonable. So the star would become unstable and collapse before it ever got close to the horizon. But anyway,
let's discuss further. I'm running out of time, I think.
This afternoon, in a discussion session, I'll show you my way of handling black hole states. I mean, you can restrict yourself to states which are not anomalous at the horizon.
You can.
It's very important to do that.
Yes, I mean, in order to get a black hole, you have to turn off this effect. That's one thing I would say. Yeah, but I would take the complementary point of view and say there is no particular reason to turn off the effect in a generic initial state. And if it is there, it's going to change the picture completely. But we can discuss. Okay, all right. So I'm basically almost out of time, if I'm not out of time. But you can obviously do the same thing in other backgrounds, and we did look at various things. We looked also at, this is going the wrong way, we looked at De Sitter space, and not too surprisingly, in De Sitter space, you have a similar behavior. If you look at it in Robertson-Walker coordinates, I think it's very important technically, and you know, for people who worry about the fourth order operators, you know, all this work that's been done in massive gravity and generalizations of GR, you're always worried about producing ghosts and higher derivative terms. And here I have it. And so I have to discuss this. And that's one of the things I've worried about quite a bit over the years. But every single test that we've put this through, it has actually passed. So the way it works in De Sitter is also quite interesting. it generalizes what I said in flat space. If you write this in De Sitter, this operator, in Robertson-Walker coordinates, this is Robertson-Walker time, this is exponential e to the h tau, Hubble term in De Sitter, this operator factorizes, and you again look at the linearized Einstein constraints, and you find that this part of it basically drops out. In other words, you don't get any new solutions unless this term is non-zero. So in other words, delta 4 on a fluctuation in the phi field can only be coupled to the metric if this quantity, which involves two derivatives already, is non-zero. So again, you get a second order wave equation. Again, you get coupling to the Bardeen potentials, which looks like this. And you can solve these constraints. So
the Einstein constraint.
If this were just the fourth order scalar theory, then of course it would have Gauss. It does have Gauss. And until you impose the constraints, those Gauss are a problem. But what you, if you impose the constraints in all cases that we've been able to look at, the problem is resolved by the Einstein equations themselves. So we looked at these equations and looked at what the solutions are like. If you use Robertson-Walker coordinates, you get something which falls off in the expanding part of the universe. It actually goes the other way, of course, if you have the full De Sitter manifold, so it can produce large effects in the contracting part of the manifold. And that should make you a little wonder and worry because, you know, De Sitter, global De Sitter is a homogeneous space, so how come I get completely different picture in one part of it as another? And that actually depends on what kind of solutions you look at. So if you decompose things by Fourier modes in the Robertson-Walker coordinates, this is your picture, but of course you can take any linear combination of them. And if you think of it instead in the static coordinates of the sitter, the static patch, then you get the picture that's very similar to what I said in the Schwarzschild case. You'll find solutions which again blow up logarithmically on now the sitter horizon. They behave logarithmically, and you can count the derivatives, and that would give you a picture of what's happening from inside. That would also tell you that if I had a patch of static De Sitter space, there should also be vacuum polarization effects building up here, which can produce the same thing looking from the inside out as from the outside in. But if you want to do cosmology, the interesting point is that the fluctuations of this object, of these gauge invariant Bardeen potentials, this difference, is actually behaving logarithmically on the two sphere. N dot n prime is the two directions on S2 for the horizon. And if you decompose that into spherical harmonics, it just gives you the condition that the coefficients are like this, which is exactly the condition on the spectral, the harmonics that you see in the CMB for low L. So it's very intriguing that with a very different picture, perhaps, than on inflation, one might be able to get the fundamental fluctuations of the CMB from this scalar rather than from putting it in by hand by an inflaton. So I think I'm out of luck and out of time. I just say here it has the correct log scaling. We'll can talk about this later on after lunch if you want. So here's the summary. I guess they don't really have to read it, but there is a macroscopic effect, which is coming from quantum mechanics. And I think we have to take it seriously, because if it's not there, well, then it's also telling us something important. But if I just follow the rules of quantum field theory and even weakly curved space-times, then I do get this degree of freedom, which is a collective mode, if you wish, coming from the underlying massless particles or light particles that come from the standard model itself. This is a quite different theory than what's been considered. It's not Brans-Dickey, it's not Hordensky that other people discuss. It doesn't couple to classical matter directly, so it's only through the trace anomaly, and therefore it's actually good news and bad news. It's hard to see, but it also passes all the tests. Everything can be worked out. And what we'd like to do is be able to do some actual dynamical collapse problem that hasn't been done, much harder, and perhaps this could be tested in gravitational waves. And thinking about dark energy and cosmology, because obviously this kind of picture has to change the vacuum energy. So I can talk about that in the discussion if people are interested. But the main message to take home is that the conformal anomaly, like the chiral anomaly, is an essential infrared window into UV physics, which I think is really trying to tell us something, and we should take it seriously. Thank you.
We're really running out of time. If you have urgent questions.
Sorry to go over.
Could you flash the references again?
The which one?
In the beginning, you put some.
In which? The conformal part or the chiral?
In the very beginning, you had some archive.
Oh, the I can give them to you. Don't worry. You won't. You don't need to write them down. I can give them to you. Any other question?
Yeah. You talk about 4D conformal anomaly and 2D conformal anomaly. Are they related in some way, like your scalar field? Is there a way to dimensionally reduce, or they're?
It's a great question. We succeeded in doing that for the chiral anomaly. So it's E dot B, and if you look in a background B field in four dimensions, then and you basically take out the two transverse directions, then the remaining two directions are exactly a two-dimensional theory, and you do dimensionally reduce to the 2D theory. Just literally, you can show that. In the 4D case, that's never been shown, but it's never been done. So people have made 2D models, but those 2D models are not equivalent to a dimensional reduction of 4D. So one has to, it's a very good open question. I'd like to try to do that.
Comment I'll make is there, because
yeah.
It really bothers me to say there's a singularity in the de Sitter horizon because there are different de Sitter horizons without any person merger. And so any effect. So what do you, I don't understand how there are de Sitter horizons going through every point.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that this effect, if you wish, spontaneously breaks the de Sitter symmetry and chooses an order, just like a bubble, right? I mean, you have a homogeneous fluid, which is nucleating bubbles. What determines whether it should nucleate here or there? Well, it's a random process. Every point is equivalent, but once a bubble nucleates, you've chosen a point. So in effect, this tells you that there should be static patches of de Sitter space that make sense, but there's no necessity for having a global de Sitter manifold. I mean, you can consider that, and we did. But my picture eventually is that de Sitter space makes sense only in a static patch, a particular choice of that origin. But it's a quantum effect, so it's saying that there's some. Spontaneous symmetry breaking, if you wish, of the full de Sitter group down to a subgroup, which is just rotations.
So another point, which you better have to consign to the afternoon, is that your particular localization of the Rieger action for the anomaly is not the only one, and there are localizations which, for at least say in the black hole case, everything is perfectly regular on the horizon. There's nothing funny happening.
It doesn't depend on the localization. Even within this one, I can find the state. As I said, there's two conditions on three parameters. If I demand those conditions and nothing says I can't, then I will find the unruh state.
Cancel out all those signatures.
Yeah, I mean you can design a state to do that, right? And other people like Paul Anderson have looked at putting any static metric, not just de Sitter or Schwarzschild, in a finite temperature heat bath and populating the modes. And what you typically find is that there's a T to the fourth contribution And in the T. Hawking fourth contribution, which is essentially this. And so indeed, by adjusting the temperature, like to the Hartle-Hawking state, you can make this coefficient exactly cancel. But any other temperature, even infinitesimally different, will produce a large effect on the horizon.
Well, but again, you're assuming the space-time is static.
Yeah, I'm assuming static, yes.
The whole space-time, not just...
Well, I'm looking for a static solution, yeah. All right, let's I know you have another several points. Yeah.
We really have to
move on, yes.
Thank you again.
Thank you.